listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It was a big night at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. The party officially nominated Hillary Clinton to be their candidate, the first woman to be a major party presidential candidate.
WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is reporting this week from Philadelphia, and he's with us now for the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Hillary Clinton officially became the Democratic presidential nominee last night. Describe the reaction that you saw last night to that moment.
Yeah, so I was on the floor of the convention hall when that happened, both when Wisconsin's delegation cast its votes officially, and then when the convention as a whole unanimously nominated Hillary Clinton. And I can tell you, both occasions were very loud, especially when the entire convention chimed in. It was deafening. And being focused on the Wisconsin delegation and knowing some of the personalities there, you could see Sanders supporters standing shoulder to shoulder with Clinton supporters, Sanders delegates and Clinton delegates. And, you know, they were the ones who were in that picture at that moment were all pretty excited at what they were doing.
And Hillary Clinton herself will speak tomorrow night. Her husband, former President Bill Clinton, gave his talk last night. Can you tell us about the substance of that talk and how it seemed to go over both in Wisconsin and big picture?
The Bill Clinton speech was really kind of a long weave of Hillary Clinton's personal life and the way that Bill Clinton described her as somebody who's can make change happen, who can get things done. You know, he wanted to describe Hillary Clinton as a person, basically, you know, to let people know that she's a mom, that she's a wife, that she cares, but then blend that in with this message of her being somebody who can get things done and make things happen. You know, I was watching the speech last night, and I think other people were, to see if there were any boos in the crowd. There are a lot of, you know, Sanders supporters here who don't like Bill Clinton, and especially, you know, some of his policies like NAFTA are hugely unpopular with the Sanders crowd. I didn't hear any noticeable boos during the Bill Clinton speech. This crowd really ate it up and went over very well with the delegates who are here in Philadelphia.
Now, you mentioned Sanders supporters standing shoulder to shoulder with Clinton delegates yesterday during that nomination process. Does that mean that that rift that we saw at the beginning of the convention between Sanders supporters and supporters of Hillary Clinton, is that diminishing as the week goes along? How would you describe where we are?
I would say it's diminishing. That first night, it was really jarring that every time Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned, she was getting booed, you know. You're not hearing that anymore by any means. They've definitely toned that down a bit. But that's not to say that it's gone away. I mean, last night, after Hillary Clinton was formally nominated, or when she was formally nominated, a number of Sanders delegates left the arena and went next door and basically occupied the media tent in an act of protest. And even in the Wisconsin delegation, I ran into one Sanders delegate who was very prominently sitting up in front after the vote. She wasn't there. I didn't see her there when the official vote was taken, but Angie Akers was there to say she's not prepared to support Hillary Clinton, and she doesn't buy into the argument that a vote for Donald Trump or a vote for Hillary Clinton, staying home and not voting for Hillary Clinton amounts to a vote for Donald Trump.
We're talking to Sean Johnson right now, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's covering the Democratic National Convention this week. And Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind spoke to the Wisconsin delegation this morning and was shouted at by some protesters, some of them seeming to be Bernie Sanders delegates. Sean, can you describe what happened there this morning?
Yeah, and this is kind of illustrative of the fact that while you may not be seeing it as much when it comes to, Hillary Clinton and the delegation as a whole, when it comes to policies like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, trade, and forceful advocates of that like Ron Kind, Bernie Sanders delegates and other protesters who are here are not afraid to speak their mind and shout people down. That's what happened today. Kind was having a speech before the Wisconsin delegation where he was talking about what he sees as you know, the good things about the TPP, and he was shouted down. And he left, and he was having a little impromptu press conference there in the hallway outside. And as you'll hear, he was quickly shouted down again.
Secretary Clinton's nomination this week, historic making here in the cradle of democracy in Philadelphia. We got a lot of work to do.
No TPP.
Excuse me, sir.
Not getting a warm reception here about TPP.
No TPP. No TPP. No bringing up to us the world at the cost of what's going on.
No TPP. So that is at the scene.
So it got pretty intense there. Yeah. They actually kind of chased him down the hallway, and he bailed, basically. He did go back into the room to listen to other speakers, but cut that press conference short.
Sean, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership emerging as a big issue at the convention?
It's no secret that it's a big issue for a lot of Democrats, and particularly Sanders supporters, and they feel like that's where the party is now. That and certainly vocal members of the party are opposed to that, and they wanted to see a party platform that more firmly rejected it. They did get language in there that opposes trade deals that are unfair in general, but not quite what they wanted. They're saying that Secretary Clinton has now come out against it, and they want her to show that she means it. But one of the Sanders delegates who was involved in that protest this morning said that he's going to kind of see how this issue plays out this year before he's 100% sure he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
There was a Bernie Sanders surrogate, Nick Carter, who spoke at that breakfast this morning. Carter is now the progressive outreach director for Hillary Clinton's campaign. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so here's an example of somebody who was in on the Bernie campaign very early, loves Bernie Sanders passionately, and has now moved over to work for Hillary Clinton. I think the most interesting thing from his speech, at least for me, was he asked for a show of hands for the Sanders delegates who were in the room. You know, hands went up. Then he asked immediately afterward who's here at their first convention. Most of those hands stayed up. So I think it shows something that we kind of knew. It confirms that a lot of the Sanders people, as we heard, are new to politics, new to formal conventions like this. And that's part of the reason you're seeing the flavor that you're seeing at this convention.
And former Minneapolis mayor and Democratic National Committee Vice Chairman R.T. Ryback had some words to share about those controversial emails from the Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. What did he want to share with people?
He came there to the Wisconsin delegation as he did in other delegations, and he apologized. In speaking to reporters afterward, he explained why.
When the emails came out from the Democratic National Committee and showed that there were some people who were showing favoritism to one Democratic candidate over another, I was outraged because we have been saying, and we should be saying, that the party is neutral in these processes. Have parties done it in the past? Yeah, absolutely. Should they? Absolutely not. So it's important to look people in the eye, tell them a mistake was made, trust was violated, we're going to clean up this mess, and most important, we're going to restore trust.
And Sean, were you able to gauge whether that apology had an impact on the people it was meant to be directed toward?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there are definitely some Sanders supporters who are still, sore over what happened there. And there was an attempt by not somebody from Wisconsin's delegation. It was actually someone in the room from Alaska's delegation, a Sanders supporter, who even after that apology tried to kind of chant him down, didn't go anywhere, and he continued his speech. So I think the answer is everybody okay with that apology? No.
The Democratic National Convention about halfway through. Sean, what's happening tonight?
Some big speakers tonight. You've got Tim Kaine, who is now officially the Democratic nominee for president. That happened just moments ago. He's going to speak tonight, and then you're going to have President Barack Obama address the Democratic National Convention. So some huge speeches ahead.
Sean, thanks so much for joining us. That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get up to speed on the craft cocktail scene here in Wisconsin.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
It's wedding season, and while wedding trends come and go, elaborate, one-of-a-kind affairs have long been in fashion. Milwaukee historian John Gerda tells us about the 1881 wedding deemed the most brilliant in Milwaukee's social history.
The wedding season is with us again. Crepe-papered cars cruise by with their horns blaring on Saturday mornings. Couples pose for pictures in the fanciest clothes they will ever wear, and even the humblest halls have been booked for months. Some of this year's nuptials will tax the ingenuity of local caterers and the pocketbooks of doting parents. But it's doubtful that any will rival a Milwaukee wedding that took place in 1881. That ceremony united a Scottish doctor, William Mackey, with a Scottish farmer's daughter, Isabella Mitchell. It was widely considered the social event of the century. Isabella happened to be a favorite niece of Alexander Mitchell, the wealthiest man in Wisconsin. Mitchell was a power in three different fields, banking, railroads, and insurance, and his home was a sprawling mansion that crowned an entire city block at 9th and Wisconsin. Although Alexander usually fit the stereotype of the tight-fisted Scot, he spared no expense for his niece and nephew-to-be. Nearly 1,200 wedding guests descended on the Mitchell mansion. They represented the cream of Wisconsin society. While they waited to congratulate the newlyweds, the guests enjoyed one of the most elaborate floral displays the city had ever seen. One massive arrangement spelled out the couple's initials in tube roses against a background of lilies, carnations, and heliotropes. Just to make sure his guests knew who was paying for all this splendor, Alexander Mitchell had his florist build another bank of blossoms with AM at the center. At the heart of the grounds was a dance pavilion that looked like something out of Camelot. Inside the pavilion hung coats of arms for the Mackenzies, McGregors, McDonalds, and a dozen more Scottish clans. Local reporters could hardly find words to describe the scene. Mitchell's estate, Gush the Sentinel, had been transformed into a purely mythological retreat that called up the recollection of stories from the Arabian Nights. Culinary splendor was evident as well. The lucky guests dined on everything tempting, reported the newspaper, in or out of season. The rarer delicacies included bone turkey with truffles, sweetbread salad, buffalo tongue with jelly, pickled oysters, and salmon salad with capers. Dinner was followed by seven kinds of ice cream, puddings, fruits, and, of course, wedding cake, nearly 200 pounds of it. When the final bottle of fine wine emptied, it was clear that the event had set a new standard for local entertaining. The evening Wisconsin called the Mitchell-Mackey wedding the most brilliant event in Milwaukee social history, without the slightest fear of contradiction. Using the wealth he commanded as Wisconsin's king of capital, Alexander Mitchell threw a party fit for royalty, and the memory of its splendid excesses lingered for decades, even among the common folk who had only watched at the gate.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and the author of many books, including Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, a cocktail that combines vodka, ginger, and lime has made a big comeback. This month, the New York Times highlighted that drink, the Moscow Mule, and a couple of Wisconsin bars that serve it up in Door County.
As cocktails go, apparently 7% of all cocktail orders last year were for the Moscow Mule. Not sure who tracks that data. It makes it almost as popular as the Bloody Mary and the Mojito. Wisconsin has a culinary culture all its own with a thriving craft cocktail scene along with the farm-to-table movement.
Kyle Cherik is here to help us track the latest Wisconsin trends for cocktails and the culinary scene in general. Kyle's the host of Wisconsin Foodie, which you can catch on Wisconsin Public Television. Kyle, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Nice to speak to you again.
Well, Kyle, what is so special about this particular cocktail, the Moscow Mule?
I think, to be honest, it isn't all that special in the sense that it got lucky. it got lucky and caught on trend as part of a larger wave of more simplistic craft cocktails that came our way the last couple of years. definitely it's delicious, and definitely people love it. But the gin and the vodka cocktails, the Moscow Mule being in the vodka camp, have been coming on strong for a couple of years now because there's so many exceptional craft distillers, micro distillers and craft distillers that are really bringing flavor back to those spirits. If you think about it, for the longest time, both vodka and gin were dominated by a couple of big names, the Stoli's and the Beefeaters, etc. And now, it was almost 10 years ago that the New York Times and David Wunderich, who is the definitive authority on spirits, named the top 10 gins in the country that were being made, and one of them was made in Wisconsin by Great Lakes Distillery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So the Moscow Mule and other drinks like the Pimm's Cup and the Negroni, both gin drinks, those are really all coming on in a big way because there's finally some really great variation and terrific vodkas and gins. But the Moscow Mule in particular, it's a really unique drink. You've got to have those copper mugs. You've got to have fresh ingredients of everything. You can't fake it. And ginger beers, which are a crucial part of it, have come on trend and are being made by some smaller craft makers across the last 5-6 years. So when you combine good and good and good, you have a really great drink.
Kyle, are mixed drinks, are cocktails really kind of a trendy sort of thing? Like, for all those people, and I've been there, you're at a bar, you want to order something, you want to look cool ordering it, but you can't think of anything. Having that name at the tip of your tongue, do they spread that way?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that that and then the skill level of exceptional bartenders that really know how to make these drinks is the other half of that equation. You feel somewhat more sophisticated, or at least I do, when I say I'd like a Negroni. I would really like a Negroni, but it's true. I would like a Negroni. And the other side of it is that, you know, as we move through this craft cocktail phase and the era of the mixologist, it got a little away from what was great about it. And I used to joke that I'd like a cocktail that doesn't have as many ingredients as a line in the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? the 14 ingredient cocktails. I mean, it's great that the mixologist could pull them off. And yes, there were some new flavors, but classic cocktails are exactly the way that classic Italian cuisine is. 4 to 5 ingredients, anything more, and you're just covering up for something that isn't already that good.
Kyle, is the cocktail scene in Wisconsin any different than nationally? Do we chart our own course in a way here? Do you see anything different going on in Wisconsin?
We drink more. Mm-hmm. I mean, for better or for worse, the tavern lobby is incredibly powerful in this state. I think probably the most powerful of any state. And we do like to imbibe. There's no question. And we also embrace a different seasonality. You know, to talk about cocktails is also to talk about craft beers. You really can't have the conversation about the sun without the moon or vice versa. And it's interesting how cocktail trends are moving more towards the bitter and the tart. The Moscow Mule would be a great example of one of those. While the craft beers are moving towards the sweet with all of these fruit beers and shandies and things like that. And it's fascinating to me that the summer shandy that Leinenkugel's had, they were the first ones to do that, and they really owned that market for about 5 years. And now you can't walk into a better place that serves craft beers or sells them without running into Sculpin and, you know, all these other fruit beers. So I think we are a flavor trend spot in the country, and candidly, I don't think we get as much credit as we ought to. And I give the New York Times a really big pat on the back for noticing that we were spot on and even ahead with the Moscow Mule trend.
Talking to Kyle Cherik from Wisconsin Foodie about trends in cocktails and beverages here in Wisconsin. I think anybody who has any interest in alcohol knows about Wisconsin's craft brewery scene. Seems like the distilling scene, you were kind of touching on this, Kyle, has really emerged in the last couple of years. How big is that in Wisconsin now?
We're not quite over 200, but it's growing. It's really an amazing thing. There was a point, Great Lakes that I distilling that I discussed earlier, they had to fight tooth and nail just to open up in Milwaukee because the old beer laws were so strict. You know, the breweries basically saw to it whether they bought the law or whether they really just were trying to get them passed for the public good, that you couldn't open a distillery in any of Wisconsin's big cities because they didn't want competition. Those laws have been wiped from the books. It's more of a level playing field now, and it seems like every time I turn around, another distillery that's really quite good is opening up in our state.
And Kyle, let's look at the food scene in general, the culinary scene in Wisconsin. What are you seeing here as far as new trends? It's eating season. It's farmer's market season.
Okay. All you need to know is that bunya cauda is the new burrata, that jackfruit is the new barbecue, and those are the things that are on trend that are moving through our culture right now.
Kyle, so, I got to say, barbecue is the only one of those four things you just said that I could pick out of a lineup.
The other two are cheese. That much I know.
Okay,
yeah.
good.
This is a
well,
kind of cheese.
And fried chicken is the new cheeseburger.
Wow. Who knew? Yeah. So bunya cauda is what? It's like a creamy cheese or something?
No, bunya cauda is this great, it's Italian soul food. And a thousand Italian grandmothers are shaking their heads and agreeing with me right now. It's this terrific roux of spices, olive oil, butter, and flavorings. And I'm seeing the enlightened chefs, the ones that are kind of on point and trends, using it now. And I've now seen it on about five or six menus from folks like that, just as I did with burrata about 2-3 years ago. Jackfruit is everywhere. And when you tear it apart and you season it, it's hard to tell the difference between that and pulled pork. And they're those big, crazy, land of the lost looking, exotic fruits. And then fried chicken, I mean, it's just become, like I said, it's become the new burger. There was a time when it seemed like there was a tax subsidy for restaurants to put great $12 burgers on their menus. Now it's all about fried chicken.
We'll leave it there for now. A taste of things to come. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Delighted. Thank you. Have a great rest of your summer.
We've been talking about food and drink trends with Kyle Cherik, host of the show Wisconsin Foodie. You can catch him and it on Wisconsin Public Television.
Coming up, we look at the ongoing conversation around wrongful convictions and the journey that comes after being exonerated. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, join NPR for continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia with analysis and live broadcast of the big speeches. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, podcasts and documentaries in the last few years have highlighted the lives of people who were convicted of crimes on allegedly shaky evidence. But if those people are granted hearings or retrials and eventually exonerated, what happens next?
In a new book called Exonery Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, investigative journalist and author Allison Flowers looks at the lives of people who were exonerated after being wrongfully convicted of crimes. She follows the stories of people who had been exonerated after being convicted and shows the struggles of life after prison.
Here in Wisconsin, Jarrett Adams was exonerated in 2007 after a panel of judges declared him wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17. He'd served almost a decade in prison before being exonerated, and he's now an attorney with the Innocence Project.
Allison Flowers and Jarrett Adams join us now. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me as well.
Allison, I want to start with the thing you start your book with. You talk about how there's not even an entry in the dictionary for the word exoneree, other iterations of that word, but not for the person themselves. What does that say to you?
Well, that's right. As I started working on this project and interviewing real-life exonerees, I discovered that as I typed the word exoneree into my computer, it was coming up on spell check and emails and Microsoft Word, you name it. And we don't have a word for the person. There's no word for this growing community of people leaving prison innocent of the crimes that sent them there, even though right now, on average, we have an exoneration every 3 days in this country. And I think it really speaks to how forgotten and how invisible these people are and the lack of resources for them.
I want to get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about here. Do we know how many people are exonerated after being convicted today?
Somewhat. There is a tracker called the National Registry of Exonerations out of the University of Michigan. They've been looking at this for a couple of years, and they basically aggregate and gather as much information they can about exonerations as they happen. I think right now we're at about We're getting close to 1,900 exonerations since 1989. But I believe, and I think they would say this too, that it's in no way comprehensive. It's not like when a case is overturned or a vacation is vacated that, you know, a court or a judge or a lawyer or anybody sends out a press release, you know, or put some sort of notification out there that this has happened. So I think there are a lot of cases being overturned where the person is actually innocent, and we're not capturing those. So 1,900, there's about one every 3 days, but at the same time, there are a lot that we miss.
Jarrett, a lot of people saying, as Allison was getting at there, that they believe this number to be much higher than it actually is. Based on your story and what you've seen, do you agree with that projection?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that because, I mean, if you just think about it, that the technology hasn't really caught up with all of the cases yet, and it's just now getting there with DNA testing and, you know, just the court acknowledging that sometimes, you know, there is, you know, fault of the criminal justice system, you know, whether it be, you know, prosecutors making a mistake or missing this or missing that. And so it's anything man-made is bound to make a human error. So that's not the biggest issue. The issue is, okay, what do we do to correct it now? You know, how do we go back and how do we make sure that justice was ensured?
And Jarrett, you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York now, but this is also a story that you've lived. You've been through this. Can you tell us some of that journey from prison inmate to exoneree to lawyer? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I spent almost 10 years of my life in prison. So I was a very young man, you know, wrongfully convicted. You know, family didn't have resources like a lot of the cases where you don't have the resources to buy an attorney. You get a public defender. This isn't a knock on all public defenders because public defenders are overworked and underpaid. And so, again, the system is fallible and sometimes things happen. You know, it took me to get the help of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and Keith Finley to advocate on my behalf and get my conviction overturned. And, you know, my record was dismissed. And, you know, I don't have a record, but I come home a 26 turning 27-year-old man with a 10-year gap in my resume, no credit history, no job skills. And so it was a very, very long road to go from someone who was, you know, wrongfully convicted, released, and then, you know, get off of my mother's couch one day and walk to school, enroll, and look, 9 years later, I'm graduating law school, taking a New York bar, and now I'm an attorney in New York. I may have made it look somewhat easy. However, it wasn't, and it took a lot of help. And it took a lot of things that I just wasn't afforded when I came home. And one of those things was just having a therapy. You know, it's like it's a traumatic experience to go through something like that. And you come home and you've lost so much time. And, you know, one of the best things that happened to me was being able to get on the couch of someone and speak to them and let it all out.
Are there structures in place, Allison, for people like Jarrett, who might be exonerated, but there's a time lapse there. They get out and it's not the same world as when they were convicted. What resources are there for these people?
Well, I think as Jarrett alluded, you know, there really are no resources. There's no aftercare for exonerees. There's nothing immediate for them. It's really a media myth that release from prison is this happy Hollywood ending. It's really not an ending. It's the beginning of another set of struggles. So when you leave prison as an exoneree, no matter where you are, you don't receive immediate compensation, not a dime. You don't even get a bus pass, which, you know, as many parolees will at least get that. There aren't any social services, no counseling, no medical, and your record is not automatically expunged. So you can't find work very easily at all. That's not to mention, you know, family members that may have died or moved on in your absence. And, you know, depending on where you were convicted, the state may or may not ever compensate you or compensate you very well. So there's still 20 states that do not offer any compensation. And many of the states that do compensate don't provide very much, Wisconsin being one of them. It's capped right now at $25,000 a year for $5,000 per year. And, you know, there was a bipartisan bill that was shut down this last legislative session that was trying to raise it to $50,000 a year for every year you were incarcerated and capping it at $1 million. And that, you know, that was not able to move forward. And so, you know, especially exonerees in Wisconsin and exonerees in those 20 states that don't have anything at all, you know, there are no immediate resources. You basically have to hope for something like a civil lawsuit, which, you know, few cases are poised to handle civil litigation. You have to have some unique circumstances in order to sue the state for millions of dollars. So those cases are just very rare, and most exonerees are left without any resources or very few resources.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers right now and attorney Jared Adams, who was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teen. He was exonerated in 2007. And I wonder about the effect of pop culture on exonerations and innocence projects. I'm thinking of Serial and Making a Murderer, taking an interest in people convicted of crimes who might have far fewer resources than people with more privilege. Jared, do you think that these cases are having an effect, are changing the legal system?
I mean, I do, and that's one of the reasons why I respect the work that Allison does and the book that she made, because it's one of these things where the more people who hear about this and who hear about this being very real, the more people who will be receptive to it and also who will be open-minded enough to say, you know what, push this legislation through. Because this isn't so much a thing now that we know that the courts are acknowledging it and you're seeing different coverages on it happening more and more. This isn't a thing that is you know, should be missed and it made about nothing but financial compensation. There's compensation that finances can never make up for. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, me coming home, it was very awkward to meet my niece and nephew at 9 and 7 years old. And, you know, we didn't know whether to hug or to shake hands because we never knew each other. And you can't make up for time like that. And I think that, you know, books like Allison's and these different series are bringing it to the living rooms of people who have never experienced this, may never experience it, and, you know, don't know anything about it. And so I think this is a very great topic to discuss. It's a real topic. And I think that we shouldn't shy away from difficult conversations in America. What makes us great is to take on these responsibilities to fix them and not point blame.
And, Jerry, you said therapy helped you when you were exonerated. That was one of the elements that helped you make this transition. Now you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York. But I'm curious about what else you'd like to see to support people who go through this. It sounds as though there is no real compensation, but maybe there's more. Maybe you'd like to see something even more systemic before we get to that point. What are you looking for?
Well, if I had the magic wand, I would like to prevent these things from ever happening. However, I'm realistic, and I know that mistakes do happen. But like I said before, I would like to see the immediate reaction of, you know, these picking up the pieces of people's lives that are ruined because of this. So I don't want to see you coming home and you got to litigate as to why, you know, you should be compensated or given therapy or given health care. There are exonerees in Wisconsin, specifically Joe Fry, you know, who came home and, you know, he's at the age of retirement right now, but there's nothing for him to retire on. And that's just completely unfair, because what we're doing on the one hand in society is saying, you know what, we're not going to compensate you or help you, and we're going to dump you back onto society. And if you don't have a job, you know, if you're not able to provide for yourself, then you become the responsibility of the taxpayers again. And I think it's totally unfair, and we should do something collectively about it.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers, and attorney Jared Adams is with us. He was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teenager and was exonerated in 2007. He's an attorney in New York currently.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guests? Do you think the criminal justice system fairly compensates people who have been wrongfully convicted? What do you think should happen when somebody's in that situation? They're exonerated, released from prison. What should they get? What should happen? And do you work in the criminal justice system? Tell us what you think about the way exonerations and convictions are being handled. Call in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation with Allison Flower. She's a journalist, author of the book Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independent, and Identity. Jared Adams is with us also. He's an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and was exonerated after serving about 9 years in prison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the criminal justice system that state governments should do for people who are released, who are exonerated, who judges rule were wrongfully convicted for a crime and then spent years, maybe many years, in prison? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or have you had an experience or someone in your family with this side of the criminal justice system? The number again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Allison, we just heard Jarrett saying that ideally these convictions, these wrongful convictions, wouldn't happen in the first place. And I assume that's part of the goal here. What needs to happen to stop them before they happen?
Well, I think really two things need to be seriously looked at. One is police misconduct. I do think that there is a strong connection between official misconduct that you see among police and prosecutors and the number of people that are being wrongly convicted. I mentioned the National Registry of Exonerations, which tracks these wrongful convictions and exonerations. And because of the known cases, about 1,900 that are out there since 1989, we're able to examine the contributing factors to how those people were wrongly convicted. And one of the leading causes is official misconduct. So that could be, you know, police having tunnel vision investigations, prosecutors hiding evidence or not disclosing evidence that is favorable to the defense, those sorts of things. Also, you know, maybe incentivizing someone to testify against someone else in court. So the number one cause contributing factor to wrongful convictions would be perjury or false accusations. And that's basically as simple as someone lying about you in court. And so if we actually look at the gamesmanship that goes on in the courtroom, if prosecutors are more concerned about getting it right rather than making a deal with someone to testify against the person they really want to get and who, you know, is later as a consequence of that wrongly convicted, I think that would go a long way in preventing wrongful convictions.
Let's take a caller now. We have Natalie with us from North Prairie. Natalie, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question. I don't think it's been talked about yet, but when you think about the ramifications of these decisions on people's lives when they're in prison for such a long time wrongfully, and I think it is evident there's no amount of money to make things right. Are there professional ramifications for the people, whatever role they played in putting someone in prison wrongly, judges, police, lawyers, are they losing their jobs? Are they being disbarred? Because if it was me, that would bring me a little bit of a feeling of justice. And I can take my answer off air.
Natalie, thanks for that question. And what about that, Jared? Are there professional consequences for prosecutors, judges?
Well, I'll be completely. Well, thank you for the call, Natalie. Very rare. It's very rare, and it's a complicated situation, and it may be so complicated to explain, so I'll sum it up and say that it has to be something that is completely egregious for a prosecutor or an official to be held liable in their capacity. There are certain things that you can do as in your role as a prosecutor or as a police officer where you're protected by that role you did it in. You know, maybe you're investigating and maybe you do have tunnel vision. You know, maybe you really did believe a person was guilty, but evidence later proved that they weren't. That doesn't necessarily mean that you maliciously did something wrong. And it's kind of a loophole that needs to be fixed. And one of the things that I've been clamoring for the longest is I believe that there needs to be a separation between the police and the prosecutors. I don't think it's fair that they are able to have a relationship to where it's a working relationship and where the roles almost become the same. A prosecutor is able to participate in the investigation portion of questioning a person. And we've seen a whole lot of things in these cases that I don't think is fair. And I think that if you have a separate entity that is reviewing the evidence before it gets to the prosecution, and then allowing the prosecution to prosecute solely on the evidence that has been presented in front of them, I think that you'll have a lot less tunnel vision. I think that you'll have a lot less turning the blind eye to misconduct by police, and I think that you'll have a better result in the system. And to also follow up on the point that I think Natalie made is, it's not just the person who's convicted and who goes through the wrongful conviction that is suffering because of this. You're talking about family members. You're talking about coming home and you don't have a home. So you're asking your family to allow you into their home. And when you do that, you know, everything goes up, all the way from the light bill to the food bills to everything. And you're a grown man in many cases staying at your family's house with no insurance or nothing to contribute to the household.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Natalie. And let's take another call now. Christy is with us next in Madison. Hi, Christy.
Hi. What was striking me as listening to all of this is just Jared, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Jared.
That you were wrongfully convicted when you were so young. And it's incredible that you had the fight in you still when you got out. And you went and you got your college education, but it just struck me that, you know, that there's potentially other people who are in that same situation, and they basically got that early years to get their college education taken away from them, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and you went back and got your college education, and that's amazing, but you also had to do it later than other people.
Christy, thank you so much for that comment. And Jared and Allison, I'm going to ask you both to chime in on that briefly. Does some sort of compensation or fund need to be set up to allow for someone's education, especially if they're a non-traditional student? Maybe they're starting later. Allison, we'll start with you.
Yeah. Well, there's one exoneree in my book named James Kleppelberg, and he was actually serving 6 life sentences for murder when he was exonerated. So he was accused of setting fire to a home that killed a family of 6. And, you know, in his situation, he was in a position where the Department of Corrections never viewed him as ever getting out. So why would they educate him, right? So, you know, he came out at retirement age as well. And, you know, he likes to say that when he went in, there were floppy disks, and he comes out and suddenly people are getting emails on their phone. I think in terms of compensation, you know, there are some states that baked into their policies around exoneree compensation do provide for some measure of education. I think that would be a wonderful thing to include. But, you know, right now there's just the state-to-state compensation laws are not uniform. And I think advocates who are seriously looking at this problem are suggesting something similar to the Texas model, which Texas actually has one of the best compensation statutes in the country. They offer $80,000 a year for every year that you were wrongly convicted, or every year that you were incarcerated, and they offer that moving forward. So it's not just trying to compensate you for the time that you lost, but acknowledging that you have the rest of your life to live as well. And, of course, you know, a lot of people come clamoring to you, whether you're an exoneree who's been compensated or not. Again, most are not. But a lot of people come clamoring to you or access to that money. So getting a huge lump sum, while of course it's better than having nothing, can also bring its own complications. So ensuring that you have resources moving forward, you know, for education or just for living your life, retirement, and so on, is very important.
And we're out of time. Thank you both so much for joining us. Jared, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Allison, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
That was Jared Adams. He is a lawyer in New York currently and was convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17, then exonerated. He's now with the Innocence Project in New York. Also, Allison Flowers joining us, investigative journalist and author of The Exoneree Diaries. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.